Well, Tomás, I'm delighted to reflect on the fact that for the final, our valedictory performance from the Statler and Waldorf box here at the National Concert Hall, we are finishing on a high. Think of it. Wagner, Strauss, Brahms.
This is without doubt an absolute peak, but it's really, there's some deep melancholy. I know they're talking about idyllic leavings is the big theme tonight, and leaving is certainly the theme, but there's such melancholy in it. It's quite strange.
There is, but at the same time, Thomas, I think in the four last songs, there's a calm acceptance of life's ending rather than, you know, railing helplessly at the gods. I feel it's a piece of where there's resolution coming in rather than resignation. There's an ease. I mean, as I said, like a great voyage ending after ups and downs and trials and tribulations, coming in calmly to finish the voyage. And I like that about it. But of course, we started with the Wagner. I mean, what to say? This is without any shadow of doubt one of my Desert Island Discs. I just love that piece. I don't know how many times I've listened to it. For me, if I need calming down or lifting up, I listen to the Tannhäuser Overture. And I think of it, you know, I think that solo horn that starts it, it sort of rises up and floats out over the strings, out into the concert hall, and then it builds and builds and builds. And I think of, you know, those great waves you see the photographs taken up near Mullach Moor and places like that, surfers, you know, coming in on these massive waves. And I think of the piece being like that. It's big and it's bold. But I think it has to be played with sensitivity, because there's the risk that it would just tumble down into loudness and bombast. So you're on a little bit of a knife edge, I think, that a control must be exercised on the power and the sound and everything. But as a building piece, it's just fantastic. It opens, for instance, Moss, you know, with that gorgeous horn solo, which just calls out and floats out into the concert above the strings. Because, you know, if you're sitting, say, close to the front of the stalls, you tend to just see in an orchestra setup, you tend to just see the strings, and the brass tend to be slightly hidden, even though they're maybe raised. But so you get this sound, and that to me, I said, you know, it's a trite cliche to say it's spine tingling, but the hair stand the back of my head. It's fantastic.
Well, for me, it just wouldn't be. I don't think I could have it as my Desert Island Disc, because frankly, I think it's the greatest overture written. Possibly the greatest overture written, I suppose. Let's caveat it a little bit. Somebody will come back with, this is better. But I can't think of a better one. And the problem is, it's too good. It's absolutely too good. Because all I want to see now, the second half, I want to see the opera. So for the rest of the night, I just want the Tannhäuser, I want the whole opera. So as an overture, it is probably the most brilliant technically, but it's also the most brilliant as a piece of advertising for the full opera. It is staggeringly beautiful. But for me, it's actually the dropping and cascading strings that's that really kicks the piece off for me. The longing, you know, the horn is longing and echoing, but then the magnificence of these cascading, it's like a slinky coming down the stairs, dropping in chords as it moves forward. Really beautiful. Absolutely gorgeous.
I think the slinky is perfect. I got one of them for Christmas years ago. And I know exactly what you mean, because it's falling down the stairs, but under control.
Yes.
And this, as you say, it's cascading down, but it's under control. There's a guiding hand to it. And that's exactly what you get here. And as you say, I suppose the frustration is that you've had the amuse-bouche, but then you're told you're not having your dinner.
When we hear a lot about failed premieres, and we certainly do, you're always hearing about failed premieres. I think about 75% of everything that was ever premiered is written off by the composer because the orchestra hadn't rehearsed enough. And then the rest of it is dismissed because some tragedy or some other event occurred. Of course, with Wagner, we have both. The second bit, the unexpected event, can't be planned for. And famously, of course, for this, came in the form of the Jockey Club de Paris. So the Jockey Club, the French Jockey Club, which isn't a jockey club, it's a gentleman's club, now on the Champs-Élysées, and the finest gentleman's club in all France. But then, occupying beautiful premises directly opposite the entrance to the Opera Garnier. And they had a habit of turning up for the ballet, where these are all the lord, the Duke of Magenta, the Duke of this, the Lord of so-and-so. So it was very aristocratic and very upmarket. And they, of course, would turn up for the ballet sequence because all of their mistresses were the ballet dancers. And they would turn up for that in 100 little boxes, which they occupied. And they would watch the ballet, and then they would politely make their excuses and go around the back to meet, as they said at that time, meet and congregate with their mistresses.
Congress?
Congregate. We won't go any further than that. It is before the watershed of midnight. And they would do this, of course. And when they turned up on the first night for the premiere of Tannhäuser, of course, Wagner had been outraged at having to put a ballet, I suppose, in the first place. He shoved it into the first act so that it could provide a little sort of a nice exposition of Venusberg, of the kind of mystical happenings of Venus's world. And so when they turn up, it's all finished. And it looks like they're going to have to stay for the whole opera. There's no excuse to get out and meet their mistresses. So there's catcalls and a wild bun fight ensues, whereby the opera grinds to a halt and is eventually pulled by Wagner after 3 days. Astonishing stuff.
I think a piece of music like this will help to, for people who don't know Wagner, I think everyone, if they hear the word Wagner, think forbidding. They think, oh, serious, you know. And if you, if they hear something like this, they'll say, hold on a second, it's beautiful music. Because his reputation seems to be of a stern, forbidding sort of character. Somebody, well, he'd a turbulent lifestyle, as we know. But he was a game changer. There's absolutely no doubt with regard to opera, of course,
yes.
You know. What was it they called it? The Gesamtkunstwerk, the complete work. He saw opera as a complete work, not just music and not just singing, the whole drawing together all the art forms, whether it's dancing or theatre or art in terms of the sets, the music itself, the singing, and of course he wrote his own libretto as well, so
yes.
The literature part of it was in there. He made things his own. He even went even further in the physical manifestation. His opera house at Bayreuth was his physical manifestation of his belief in that complete work of art and how it should be staged. So, for instance, at Bayreuth, you cannot see the orchestra. You see nothing at all. Now, you know yourself, we're used to in an opera, there's always the dim lights coming from the thing where you see the faces in shadow and a little bit of light, the light shining down onto the music. There's none of that. There's a great big sort of a cowl in Bayreuth, completely obliterating any view. So the only man who knows everything that's going on, of course, is the conductor. He's like a policeman at a busy interchange. He can see down to the orchestra, who sit literally underneath the stage, and he can see up to the players. So he's on a very heavyweight responsibility, of course, there. And that's what they would always say, that opera conducting is the ultimate thing for a conductor.
Gesamt. Total music, total football, as I like to think about it. So this is the total package. But another part of the visual that's going through my mind, and it's something that would go through the minds of many people under the age of 35, of course, like ourselves, is that this is really evocative in the 20th and 21st century, or has been reworked by Blade Runner. Marvellous science fiction film by Ridley Scott, starring Rutger Hauer. And Rutger Hauer improvised a beautiful speech in the middle of this fantastic sci-fi film, which he said wasn't written by Ridley Scott. And the interesting thing is that there's a lot of debate about whether Ridley Scott's Blade Runner really is simply a reworking of Tannhäuser, the entire opera and the story. And then, therefore, this would make sense because Rutger Hauer is discussing this every evening with Ridley Scott. They know that that's what they're doing because it's about a soldier who takes a journey and he does lots of terrible things that he's very ashamed of subsequently. Then he travels back to meet his spiritual guider and creator. In the case of the science fiction film, it's a man who runs a thing called the Tyrell Corporation, who's there saying, do you like our owl? And he's created all these beautiful things. And Rutger Hauer is back to see, can he get salvation? Can he end the sell-by date that he actually has within him? So he goes back to see a man who created him, Tyrell. And of course, and he created him and gave him his spiritual dimension and a physical dimension, because the Rutger Hauer character is essentially, or he's the soldier Tannhäuser, he's also a replicant, a robot, a creation. And so he goes back to see, can he be saved, essentially, by this man? And, of course, Tannhäuser, in the opera, goes to the Pope to see, can he save him from all these terrible things he's done? The Pope says he can't save him, And he said, you know, you'd be more likely that my staff, you know, the staff would grow, sprout again, the Pope's staff, than he could give him salvation. Tannhäuser goes off into a frenzy away for the rest of the thing, before getting salvation eventually. And, of course, the Pope's staff reignites. In Blade Runner, the Replicant goes off into a frenzy of killing after killing his creator. And then he has a little speech where he talks about having seen starships on fire in sea beams at the Tannhäuser Gate. And it's all there echoing, and it's telling us that this is essentially Tannhäuser the movie. And the music is very, very interestingly, it's by Vangelis, and it does evoke some of the moods and movements, and even if you're listening very carefully, you can certainly impose some of the structures that Wagner has in the heart of this. So it's a story as well that rings true. There's another connection that's more worrying for us all, and I think that's something that it's hard to get over anymore. I mean, I've changed my mind. Between Wagner and Strauss, what you have is you have two people who've had terribly troubling public images in the latter half of the 20th century, essentially being tarred and feathered with an association with National Socialism, with the Nazis in Germany. And, of course, it's hugely unfair, massively unfair, in the case of both of them for different reasons.
Yes, exactly. And I think also, Tomás, I often wonder about Strauss's reputation. I mean, he's a towering figure in many respects, and he straddled an extraordinarily, varied period in world history. Huge change, social change, cultural change, economic, political, and so on and so forth. I sometimes wonder, and this is just a quirky little theory of mine, is it because his name is Strauss that maybe he isn't as highly regarded as perhaps he should be? Because we think of Johann Strauss, the King of the Waltz,
yes.
Blue Danube and the rest of it, light little stuff to be played at afternoon tea dances or something like that. I often wonder, does he get subconsciously associated with that? Because he certainly isn't that at all. If you think of Der Rosenkavalier, for instance, and now, of course, the Four Last Songs, these are epic pieces of music, absolutely wonderful pieces of music. But he seems to get left out of that sort of that canon. Maybe another reason is that he straddled, he didn't belong really to one epoch or era, but he sort of straddled across. I mean, think about it, Tomás. He was Brahms was alive when Brahms and Wagner were alive when he was born. He could have known them. And then he died after when the Cold War had come in. So there's a huge change there. And I just wonder, is it difficult to pigeonhole him and say he was part of this or he was part of that? And that perhaps leads to him getting overlooked rather than underrated, shall we say.
I think I agree, but I'd have to put it further. And that, of course, he was made, he was essentially made the head of the national, so he was head of the Nazi
the Reich
music,
musical
the Reich
Commissar.
Music, yeah, exactly.
Very
so
naive.
He was the Reichführer of music. Now, he was appointed that. He did not ask for it, and he didn't hear about it till it had been announced in the papers. You know, Wagner, it's just a calumny. To associate him with the Nazis, dead long before any of this kind of horror even emerged. Strauss is more difficult, but in fact, as I've grown up, as I've gone back and re-examined it without having sort of the Sex Pistols blaring into my ears while trying to think about Richard Strauss's place in music, and seen the complexity of his life, you know that in fact he was dismissed in 1933 as the Reich Musikführer because. He'd written several letters describing the Nazi Party and both Goering and Hitler as, you know, people who were appalling, people who were a disaster for culture and for humanity, and he completely rejected all of their interests. That got him fired. He had a son who married a Jewish woman. He had Jewish grandchildren. He had Jewish mothers-in-law. He spent a lot of time during the war years and even before the war trying to keep them safe and work his way around this.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the final call. All doors are now closing, and we request that you take your seats in the auditorium immediately. Final call, ladies and gentlemen. All doors are now closing.
Now, you know, the problem is that a lot of American critics have jumped on board this. But if a regime came along in America tomorrow that they disagreed with, their reaction now What they seem to want is they wanted everybody of substance in Germany to have simply got on a plane and left. That's what they seem to have wanted. So he was as distant as he could be. He rejected them philosophically and politically and socially and culturally. And he kept playing all the band works. He kept playing Mahler. And he was, you know, there was no, you know, no credible association there at all. But it still lasts. So there's still this taint is still there in his music. But when you listen to those four last songs, particularly the last two, I mean, I think they are, without doubt, some of the most beautiful, most poetic evocations of this problem, death, that we have.
It occurs.
It occurs.
Well, looking forward to most, we've got Brahms still to come. Probably not his most popular symphony, or best-known symphony. I mean, his first symphony, which was slightly, perhaps cruelly, nicknamed as Beethoven's Tenth Symphony, tends to get a lot of the credit. But this one, I think it's well-programmed in here because, although perhaps they're not very closely associated, it doesn't break the mood. The lovely mood that has been set by the four last songs is not broken by what comes after. So it's not a big beating, crashing cymbals or anything like that. It's a lovely piece. And I remember one time talking to Gerhard Markson, used to be the principal conductor of the RTESO, and I was talking to various conductors and the rest of it, you know, and he said, listen, Carlos Kleiber was the man. Carlos Kleiber, you cannot get past what he did. He did very little work. He was a troubled man. But one concert of his that still remains recorded on video is with the Vienna Philharmonic playing Brahms' Second Symphony. And, of course, Vienna Philharmonic did the premiere of it way back when. But Carlos Kleiber, watching him conducting, I've never seen anything like it. He's like, it's like a sculpture or an artist. He's waving his arms around like in a sort of an ecstatic, sort of trance-like state, and just drawing the music out of the orchestra. It's absolutely magnificent. And he's smiling the whole time. But he was a very troubled man. I've heard it said about him that he had this notion of the perfect sound inside his head, which he could never match. No matter who he was playing with, Vienna Phil, Chicago, whoever it was, he never felt that he reached that. And I remember hearing Placido Domingo talking about him. And Placido was talking in a sort of a serene voice, "Oh, Carlos," he says, "he was so good." And Domingo remembered, you know, about to come on stage, waiting in the wings at the Met in Othello. And he said he could look out and he could see Kleiber conducting. And the audience were watching Kleiber. They weren't watching what was going on. He said it was quite chilling to find. They had such a fascination with the man. And his recording of the Brahms Second is absolutely beyond compare for me. And I think it's a lovely, peaceful. They say, of course, again, comparing back to Beethoven, they say maybe this one follows on from his sixth, his Pastoral Symphony.
Absolutely, and I was going to say, will I have a big fight now with Raymond? We shouldn't. We should be taking our leave happily, you see, at the end of this. But the Bernstein and Berlin, for me, that's where I found my best version of Symphony Number 2. Again, a symphony that was considered melancholic at the time. So, you know, it fits in with our melancholic leave-taking this evening very, very nicely. But, I mean, I'm listening to many of these versions, and I hope now when we see this now in the second half that we're going to see what I think is a much more sprightly, very much the pastoral resurrection. There's some moodiness in the first movement, but other than that, it feels like if there's melancholy, it's melancholy in that traditional or in the original romantic sense, that kind of that ethereal despair that brings you to self-reflection and acceptance and so forth, which is again part of the what was going on in the four songs, and especially the final song. And one of the beautiful elements there is that the soprano finishes with a good 5 or 6 minutes to run before the fourth song is finished, and finishes on the phrase "tot dead," you know, "is this death?" she says, and the word "death" is left there, "tot," and then she has to stand there for 5 or 6 minutes in repose while this most beautiful theme plays out, slowly fading. The long fade. I mean, I think if I was programming it, I'd be so tempted to put that as the climax of the evening as it fades out. But we're going to end with a bit of a bang with this, which I think is what we want, an uplifting movement.
we're not ready to fade out just yet, are we?
Absolutely not.